This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run. I'm Sharad Kutan, and it's time for Pressing Matters, the show that goes behind the headlines. Today with me, Tan Chung Han, and also our guest, P. Gunasegaram, independent business analyst. Thank you for joining us, Guna. Welcome. We're going to begin with the commentary that you wrote on the East Coast Rail Link, entitled 10 Reasons Why We Don't Need the 55 Billion Ringgit East Coast Rail Link. So you kind of like, it says it all in the title, but before we get to the meat and to those 10 reasons, let me just do a quick recap, at least on some basic factoids about the ECRL. The project was launched last week on Wednesday. It covers almost 700 kilometers of rail. It will span two destinations, I think, from tip to tip, Gomba in Selangor to Kota Baru in Kelantan, expected.
Also to Port Klang.
To Port Klang. It's expected cost, as we said, 55 billion ringgit. The project owner is Malaysia Rail Link, but it will be built by China's state-owned China Communications Construction Company, or CCCC. Now, the CCCC won the contract via direct negotiation and not open tender. The expected completion date is 2024. Now, this is the number we have, 55 billion, in a piece that economist Joma Sundaram wrote for The Edge entitled ECRL Folly Bound to Burden Nation. Again, one of those titles that leaves you no doubt about the position of the author. Mm-hmm. He does mention the question of mega projects and cost overrun. So he's saying that this 55 billion ringgit bill might actually not be the final number that we have on that. And that's one of the comments he makes in his piece.
Typically, mega projects, there are huge cost overruns, and it can be from 50 to 100%.
Okay. So, Guna, let's begin with, the arguments that you lay out. And you look squarely at the numbers that are given in terms of not just the cost, but the projected revenue and income from the project, right? The expected benefits from this. And what are you saying essentially? You're using your own measure. Could you just give us a quick rundown about why you think this is not economically feasible?
I think, in this case here, when you look at economic feasibility, you look at the cost of the project. Let's just take it at 55 billion. It's not clear whether this includes the cost of acquisition of land. And according to reports coming out, as much as 55% of the land will have to be acquired. So that will add on a cost to it. And then it's not clear whether it includes the cost of rolling stock, basically the trains, and the locomotives. I don't think it does. So if you add on all of it, your cost may be well in excess of 60 billion, maybe 65 billion. But let's just use the figure 55 billion. If you want a sort of a project return on this of 10%, then you're talking about a profit, not turnover, of 5.5 billion. So we have had experience with the double track project. This is the ongoing 36 billion double tracking project, which is from Padang Besar to Johor Bahru. And of course, the feasibility report for this study as well was not released, but it was touted as a huge, big game changer, and that it will increase KTM's revenue substantially because freight will be used and so on. But if you look at KTM's figures, for this, KTM had a revenue of 1.1 billion in 2016. These are publicly available figures, from which it obtained a cash flow of a mere 166 million. You're talking about revenue, which is only 3% of the cost of double tracking, which was 36 billion. Most of the double tracking has been completed. The stretch which is still not completed is from Gabas to Johor Bahru. So 3% of the revenue, while operating cash flow is a mere 0.5%, not anywhere near enough to cover the interest cost of the projects. So for a 10% return on cost, cash flow needs to rise over 20 times to ringgit 3.6 billion a year. So this one, you're talking about the double tracking project, which is already there.
But just because the double tracking failed doesn't mean that this will fail. It doesn't follow necessarily.
Well, the more developed area is the backbone, is the West Malaysian backbone, the peninsula, the west coast of the peninsula of Malaysia, to be exact. So you're talking about the major development which is taking place along this coast, and it's still you don't seem to be having enough traffic. So here what you're having is the line running from Fort Klang to Kuantan and then to Tumpat, you know. And essentially, a lot of it seems to be built on this premise that you sort of land your goods at Port Klang and then take it over to Kuantan by train, by this train, and then re-export it from there. You know?
Reship it. Bypassing Singapore.
Bypassing Singapore and
Johor.
And even Malacca, if there's going to be a port in Malacca. But there is actually a port which is being planned in Malacca, and there's a huge big development which is being planned in Port Klang around the Kerry Island radio, area, which will eventually cost maybe as much as $200 billion. So,
I mean, could it be that this infrastructure is being planned for a future that we don't yet see, which is that increased demand for these services? I mean, is that possible?
All right, then give us the feasibility report. Is it, why is there no feasibility report, you know, about how this is going to take place? You know, the other figure is to look at, Singapore's port. Singapore's port, which is basically Port of Singapore Authority, had a turnover of 11.7 billion ringgit, you know, so which means Singapore does not just ship to China, but they you know, it's a major transshipment port. People bring your cargo there and then it is reshipped to other destinations in both directions, you know, to the east and west of Singapore. And this is 11.7 billion ringgit, and the profit was just 3.16 billion. For the double tracking, if you are working on a 10% rate of return, you want a profit of 5.5 billion ringgit, you know? And so are you saying that you're going to take over all of Singapore's profit plus even more than that, you know, in this in the future? Not likely, you know, because you know, so the figures don't support an ECRL.
Well, know? Often when it comes to these kind of massive infrastructure projects that involve, you know, government involvement, very often you don't just look at it from the financial perspective, right? Like, because often the idea is for it to generate enough economic activity or have
Kind of economic activity would it create? You know, so basically, okay, the common one which is said is, oh, it will lead to plenty of development of towns along the rail, you know, track. But that does not necessarily happen, is it? You know that you have a track going all the way in the middle of Peninsula Malaysia, right up to, you know, from Gemas, right up to the north, you know.
What
development has there taken place which is extraordinary? Arguably, the roads provide more development than rail, actually. And you already have a highway which links Kuala Lumpur to Kuantan, and that highway is going to be built up north towards Tumpat. And the construction is taking place for that as well.
Well, given the government's push for that Eastern Corridor economic region, right? You know, like, wouldn't the ECRL then make sense? Like, wouldn't it facilitate again the rebalancing of the economic growth between the east and the west of Peninsular Malaysia, right? So, wouldn't a railway, whether or not it's economically feasible, whether or not the numbers add up, you know, if you consider the potential, you know, social spillover effects, you know, economic spillover effects, wouldn't it make sense then?
It may be better perhaps to start off smaller first, you know, for these kind of things and see, and then you build the rail in steps. Perhaps the first thing should be Kuantan, you know. Right. Why build the whole thing right up to Tumpat, you know? Where is your carriage going to be, you know? Take it in, you know, we are not even sure that it's going to be double track. There are some reports which says that it's going to be a single line and built according to a double track kind of a formation, and I don't understand what that means. So there is a huge lack of information, but if you look at the major overall figures, it doesn't look like it is economically feasible at all. And I'm not sure that the government can afford to subsidize such a huge amount. Right, this is being built with perhaps, you know, from with financing, 85% financing from China, which is at a concessional rate of 3.25%, grace period of 7 years and things like that. But you cannot run away from the fact that eventually you will have to pay this back. So you can't use this easy credit scheme. You don't have to pay now. This government will not be accountable for it. To go on this kind of a massive spending spree, which will fall on the shoulders of future generations.
Yeah, I mean, just to balance it out, or just to provide the other side of the story, you've got commentary from the Transport Minister, Dato Sri Liao Tiong Lai, saying that this ECRL, when completed, maybe by 2030, it is expected...
2024, I think, is the completion date.
Oh, okay.
Which is rather quick.
Right, yeah, 2024. But then by 2030, this ECRL is expected to serve over 5 million passengers per year. It's expected to carry over 50 million tons of cargo once completed. So again, obviously, the government having a different view of the potential for this ECRL.
Sure, but where do the 50 million tons of cargo come from? If I'm not mistaken, KTM is about 4 to 5 million. So, I mean, you are looking at huge quantum increases in existing usage for this to be viable. And the only thing seems to be is the link from port to port, from Port Klang to Kuantan.
We'll be back with more. You're listening to Pressing Matters. Our guest, P. Gunasekaran, an independent business analyst. And we're talking about the East Coast Rail Link, or ECRL. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. Good morning and welcome back to Pressing Matters, the show that gets behind the headlines. We have as our guest today, P. Gunasekaran, independent business analyst, and myself, Sharad Kutit, with my co-host, Tan Chung Han. We've been talking about the East Coast Rail Link, and Gunnar, you've been giving us some numbers and also suggesting that the numbers projected in terms of either capacity or demand for that capacity, passengers, freight, all that is overblown. It's unlikely if you compare... the current state of things, KTM's carriage, or even what Singapore earns from its business in ports. Where do we go with the story? I mean, do we need to go back to the question of why? Why was this project even conceived? Why would the Malaysian government agree to it? Why are the Chinese, in this case through its state-owned enterprise, CCCC, why would they be even interested in such a project if it's not economically viable?
I think for the Chinese, I think it is basically a way... another avenue to promote the movement of goods in and out of China. So this may offer a cheaper alternative by transshipping the goods between Port Klang and Kuantan, obviating the need to go around the peninsula. So that there apparently is some savings of cost there, but of course, no figures are available as to the amount of traffic that you can get from this that can be diverted from the existing ports. So that seems to be the main reason why this is going through, although this is not officially stated. Officially, they are talking about development to the East Coast and things like that, which there is already a road which is there, and this rail will be in addition to the road. So the road will be the one which will bring the greater development than this at this point of time, because there is not that amount of development which is taking place in the East Coast at the moment.
Well, Gunnar, you're certainly in good company because you even have the Prime Minister's brother, who is also Dato Sri Nazir, who actually also asked for greater scrutiny on this project, right? And basically other large-scale Obor-related infrastructure projects as well. And also, just to quote Wan Sai Fu Wan Zhan, he wrote a column recently saying, and I quote, "We borrowed money from China in order to pay a Chinese company to do the job. And after 7 years, we still need to pay back the loan plus interest again to China." Now, I mean, help us see the flip side here. So you're obviously in good company there, but what could be the possible rationale here? I mean, I know you've listed 10 reasons why we don't need it, but play the devil's advocate then.
All right. The rationale does not seem to be economic. That is essentially the point. So what is it? I mean, coming back to your question,
Politics of it.
About why is it going ahead? I suppose it's a large project. Large project means contracts. But the thing is, so people are salivating at the chance of getting at this contract, and there'll be a lot of locals who will get it. And of course, there's the flow of patronage and even corruption, which this project will, which there are many opportunities for this to take place in this project. You know?
Let's hope not.
Yeah, let's hope there is a major
fingers
check
crossed.
And balance against that.
But what about the idea of us having to again shift to the tremendous influence of China, because it's not just a Malaysian-centric story. Many other countries also have to accommodate this new behemoth on the global stage.
But China is trying to make this project more feasible by giving very cheap financing and even grace period, so that you think about repayment only a few years down the line. But as has been pointed out, there are a number of projects overseas where China has done similar financing. For instance, there is a Sri Lankan port which is hardly being used at the moment, and according to reports, Sri Lanka has handed over the port to China on a 99-year lease arrangement. So again, I'm not sure what exactly is the lease arrangement here.
Right.
So you don't want such a situation also happening in Malaysia. You have to look at the if it is not long-term viable, the project should not go ahead, period.
Sure.
But I wonder if this is a peculiarly kind of economic perspective. I mean, a perspective that, say, economists who are doing the comparative analysis will come to. Whereas, and I'm just reading some of the comments to your opinion piece in Malaysia Kini, and people are like, but Gunnar, the double tracking is not a failure. It was a great success. It's so wonderful. And, people look at even the IMRT project, when we talk about the numbers, it doesn't seem to be as captivating as the experience of it. So people are really bowled over by the spectacle, right, of this great, modernized rail system or whatever. They don't think about the cost which is what you and Jomo seem to be arguing, that's going to come down to us in years to come.
And then adding to that as well, beyond the cost as well, it's, again, the spillover benefits, right? Because there obviously was a real pent-up need among travelers here in the Klang Valley for the MRT. And likewise, you do see that disparity in the how fast the West Coast was developed versus the East Coast. Obviously, the road or that highway was not cutting in, right? So perhaps that railway would be the catalyst for heightened development, right?
Actually, a lot of freight is, I suspect, I don't have the figures, is transported by road. I mean, anecdotally, I take the NKVE every other day, which is actually basically the link to the ports. And the amount of container loads on the roads are tremendous. So road may be even cheaper than rail as a means of transport. And it takes you from point to point. So unlike Europe, for instance, we don't have a rail network. We have rail backbones. That's it.
What about having to, again, pander, going back to the point of having to pander to China, because so for the first half of this year, they accounted for over 16% of total trade, Malaysia's total trade, right? So, what do we risk if we do not say, yes, we'll build that ECRL? What do we risk if we say, okay, we don't participate in OBOR?
I don't think there will be much of a risk if you don't. Singapore doesn't subscribe to OBO, for instance, maybe because they are being sidelined by China's policies, because it's in China's interest not to have Singapore as the main port. For me, it is a question of are we serving China's interests or our own? So that's a question that you not all of OBO is wrong. But you need to see whether it also suits your own interests. You look at one point I'd like to make is the figure that has come out subsequent to the launch. 70% of contracts will go to CCCC. Only 30% will come to the locals. So that means, there is a huge amount of outflow of funds to outside the country over the next few years as a result of this project.
Okay, just very quickly, Gunnar, just kind of following on what Hans' train of thought, is there any way that this project could be turned around and could be beneficial to the nation on balance?
I think probably you don't. Most likely, you don't have a need for this project at this point of time. Now, I think if you, I do not know if you travel very often on the on the expressway to the east, the traffic there is not at all like the North-South Expressway, for instance. So there is still not that amount of demand for transport to the East Coast yet to justify such a project. The only way it can be justified is if it's a port-to-port transport thing, from Port Klang to Kuantan, and both ways, and then it's transshipped elsewhere. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Gunnar. Right. And of course, if you want to read Gunnar's article, you can subscribe to Malaysia Kini, where Gunnar's column is. Thank you again. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Tan Chung Han. And this has been Pressing Matters. We're coming up to the top of the hour. We'll have the news, and then you'll have Enterprise with Frida Liu. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.